Hi, everybody. Thank you for attending this historic Zoom conference on Jordan, past, present, and future. We have a wonderful list of speakers, and we'll get right to it. My name is Ted Bellman. I'm the editor of Israel Pundit, and I will be giving you the first address.
I'm going to start off by introducing my relationship with Mudar. I met Mudar shortly after making Aliyah, which was 12 years ago. And there was a woman in Jerusalem who was a fanatic about the Jordan option. And she used to bring Mudar in from England to talk to a certain number of individuals. And I met him on a few occasions when he would come to Israel. I was intrigued by his attitude, where he was coming from. Here's a guy, I think, that 20 years ago, he was, in his own mind, going to become the leader of Jordan. Like, his whole life has been dedicated to this one thing. And his background is that his parents were Palestinians who fled in 48, I think, to Jordan. And they ended up in America. And Mudar got his master's in America. And then when the family moved back to Jordan, he was vetted by the intelligence agencies, and he joined the American embassy in their intelligence department. Now, Mudar was very outspoken, got him into a lot of trouble with the king. And ultimately, Mudar had to flee the country to Britain and ask for asylum. That was well over 10 years ago. And the king went on to convict him in absentia. I don't know if it was a life sentence or 15 years, but a very severe sentence. And Mudar spent the rest of his time in London, where he got his PhD in Middle East affairs. So academically, he's no slouch. And he's always been dedicated to this. Now, a while back, Mudar was putting together his coalition that he represents right now. And the coalition, he drafted a 14-page proposal that he wanted all the members of the coalition to sign. And I think he was dealing with 13 different Palestinian refugee camps in Jordan. And he would talk to me and because he wanted to know what I thought about what his platform was. And I had my own views as to what I wanted it to be. And I felt that I was there for me or for Israel, not for him. But he had the problem of selling whatever he agreed to with me. He had to sell it to the various Palestinian groups. And they were all on board. And I'll tell you shortly what I asked for. And then in a very excited fashion, he called me up to say that even the largest Bedouin tribe has just signed on. And everybody associated the Bedouins with supporting the king. So that was the beginning of the coalition. Now, what I had determined, some of the things that I really wanted, I was totally caught up with Martin Sherman's compensated emigration. His plan, as you know, called for millions or billions of dollars. He wanted to give 300,000 to each family to leave as a as an inducement. And he couldn't get any traction with that. But he certainly, I bought into the idea because I thought that we will never negotiate a deal with Palestinians, with the PA, or even with Jordan, because the gap is too far apart. So I don't have any confidence in negotiations. I believe in unilateral movement. It's the only way you're going to achieve anything. But as a variant of what Martin Sherman was asking for, I thought, well, if we can get the Palestinians to move to Jordan, that's a lot cheaper, and let's look at that. So I said to Mudar, we want you to clean up the Palestinian or the Jordanian citizenship of all Palestinians. And the citizenship was very important to me. They all were citizens, but Abdullah tried to cancel it, tried to undo the citizenship. And surprise, surprise, Amnesty International said you can't undo it. So he was stuck with it, but he limited it in many ways. In any event, Mudar was quite happy to say, you know, should I come to power, we will restore the citizenship. Now, what was important about the citizenship was that we're all worried that if we annex all the land, we'll have to give citizenship to all the Palestinians or be considered an apartheid state. And that was a huge hurdle. But as an interesting point of law, that you do not have to give citizenship to people who are foreign citizens, only stateless people. So if we could clean up the issue of citizenship, then would there be no obligation on our part to give them citizenship, or as Carolyn Glick said, even, you know, having high hurdles to get. No, we don't want more citizens. So that was a very major idea. And this was all agreed upon. And Mudar and I felt that during the Obama years, we had to lay low. And as soon as Trump came into office, we both realized that now was our opportunity. Trump was totally different. As a matter of fact, in the 2016 Republican convention that they held, Trump had a very big part in removing the two-state solution and the Palestinian entity or state from anything on the Republican platform. It was a very, very big issue. And he just said, we don't want to be fettered by anything. We're open to everything. And so Mudar and I decided now we have to go into action. And one of the things that we decided early on was that we were not going to try and convince the Israeli electorate or the U.S. electorate. We wanted to do this on an executive action basis, just like Obama put Morsi, or throughout Mubarak, put Morsi in power as an executive action. You didn't have to convince the people. He just did it. And we thought that's our avenue. We want to convince Trump to do an executive action, basically to put Mudar in power. So that for that reason, we didn't go out to everyone. But what we did do is plan a conference at the Begin Center in 2017. And our ideas were developing along the way. We had a lot of opposition from key Zionists who, for whatever reason, they didn't like Jordan as an option. I don't want to speak for them, but the conference itself was very, very intellectually stimulating, and the people who attended it were very encouraged by it. I should once mention one other thing. One of the things which drove me and was part of my background of important ideas was a book written by one of our speakers today, Mordechai Nissan. I think it was Only Israel West of the Jordan. Fabulous little book explaining why that is the case. Only Israel West of the Jordan. And Mudar and I decided that the Jordan peace agreement is upheld and the Jordan River is the border and everything west of the Jordan is for the Jewish homeland. So we had no trouble with that concept. Now, the first article that I wrote was about a month later, was the ultimate alternate Israeli-Palestinian solution. And that's what it was called at that time, because Trump was looking for an alternate solution to what had been proposed. And so I wrote about these ideas, and I went on to say that once Mudar fixes the citizenship and opens up the door to the emigration of the Palestinians, then it's our job to provide the incentives for the Palestinians to emigrate to Jordan. And one of the incentives that was mooted in that particular article was to build a city of 1 million Palestinians, which would hire a lot of people to build, which was one aspect. And that would attract Palestinians. But even more so, we decided to give the homes that were built free of charge to the people who emigrated. Now, that may sound like a lot of money, but in Jordan, as we learned from our research, a home can be built for $16,000, and compare that with Martin Sherman's $300,000 per family. And so I just raised that issue as an example of how we might induce the Palestinians to leave. So then one of the people who attended the conference, who wants to remain nameless, very, very sharp guy in the real estate business. He has a career of doing all the groundwork for real estate projects of over $100 million each, knows his stuff. And he already had identified a city in Jordan that could be built and where it could be built. And he had all the numbers and the breakdown. And that particular article includes all his ideas. So going further in the recommended reading, the memo to Kushner that was written 2 years later. And it, the reason I wrote it was that Lieberman had entered the fray, and Lieberman decided that he wanted Gaza to be a Palestinian state, number one, or the beginning of it. And he wanted not only that, he wanted, he wanted for Gaza to become sovereign Palestinian territory, and that Palestinians receive broad economic incentives. And it was my preference, and I, in this memo to Kushner, I wrote that the residents of Gaza should be induced to voluntarily emigrate to Egypt or Jordan or other places as they chose. And we also had a lot of numbers in Egypt. And it turns out, surprisingly, that new homes in Egypt are half the price of what they are in Jordan. And that particular article goes into that in great detail, showing how Egypt is in dire need of this money that would fill their homes. And actually, if there's 1.3 million out of the 1.6 million Gazans, 1.3 who are refugees, if you have a 10-year project, that means 130,000 a year, which is a little over 1% of the Egyptian population. They wouldn't even notice it. So in addition on that article, I talk about the water problems in Jordan, and we had plans and ideas for how they might be solved. Now, the next article you see is Trump's war against UNRWA will benefit the Palestinian refugees. That's a hugely important article because it deals with the difference between UNRWA and UNTRA. The other one, UNTRA, is that how you pronounce it? And there's really basic differences. UNTRA has a mandate to get everybody settled away, and it doesn't apply to the children of refugees. And in order to be a refugee, you have to flee your home, a longstanding home, not temporary home, to be classified as a refugee. And over the years, many, many millions of so-classified refugees found refuge. And that's the function of UNHCR. But UNRWA is entirely different. UNRWA has the obligation to maintain your refugee status until God knows when, and they have no desire to end it and solve the problem. They want to keep them in limbo, and it applies to all their children. So therefore, the numbers escalate tremendously, and thanks to Trump, and also, by the way, you don't have to live there a long time. According to UNRWA, you just have to live between June 46 and 48, because they wanted all these temporary people to be considered refugees. And under the UNHCR rules, they wouldn't have been considered refugees. And so there's a number of issues of that. Even in UNRWA, like UNHCR, you had to be forced to flee, but not UNRWA. And so there's no fleeing, because most of the people there, to be a refugee, in a sense, is you're fleeing a border. There's no border. They stayed within the country. So that's an article, very, very informative. I highly recommend that you delve into it. It's very technical, very detailed. And I want to raise another issue that came to mind. When I wrote my article, which is also listed in the articles about international law in Israel, and I was tracing a few things through, and I found something very, very interesting. As you know, the Second World War ended only a little bit earlier than the 48 war, like 3 years earlier. And there was all kinds of redrawing of borders and moving populations. That was considered necessary to arrive at peace. They called it at the time, and this is in a Der Spiegel article, they called it ethnic homogenization. Hmm. They believed in the principle of ethnic homogenization, they being the European victors. And this is something that Martin Sherman and other strong voices have argued for. We can't have peace in Israel if there's no ethnic homogenization, which means that you cannot have two narratives, two nation states. You cannot have a Nakba. You can't have any of these things interfering with ethnic homogenization. It becomes imperative that people emigrate who aren't of the basic ethnicity. Now, on that issue, the UNRWA was set up specifically to prevent the homogenization, to introduce all kinds of false ideas, to classify all these people as refugees on a permanent basis, and they flew totally in the face of what was happening in Europe only 3 years earlier. People don't realize that special rules were arranged at that time to apply to what happened in Israel. So that was in a very important part. Okay, so I highly recommend that particular article. Then there is another aspect to that, to those two fundamental ideas, is that what are we going to do with Oslo, and what are we going to do with Jordan? Now, Oslo is a huge problem for us. For that matter, giving the keys to the Jordanian Waqf is also an enormous problem for us, as we see. And the Arab insurrectionists, if you will, who are leading all these terrors and violence and whatever, for which we are blamed, that's all because we give too much power and authority to the PA, and we have to change the rules of the game. We have to exclude all kinds of speech as being seditious, and we're not doing our job there, but we have to take this matter in hand, and we're stuck with it. So what the Jordan option anticipates over time is that Jordan, because you're not going to move 2 million refugees out of the Judean Samaria so fast in Gaza. Jordan, this is a long process, and we wanted to figure out how Jordan can replace the PA and replace UNRWA. And so, as you will recall, when Trump came into office, we were already reaching out to him and to Kushner with our ideas, although we never communicated directly. We're pretty certain they were tuned in. And we took UNRWA to task, we took the PA to task, and what Trump began to do was cut them down to size. Remember, he closed the so-called embassy of the PA in Washington. He cut off their financing. He cut off UNRWA's financing. He raised the issue of how do you define a refugee. He was totally into all of that. So we're continuing along that line. So what we, as another inducement to get the refugees to leave, was that if UNRWA is closed, shut down, then where do the 2 million, there's actually 2 million refugees, UNRWA refugees, living in Gaza and Judea and Samaria and East Jerusalem even. And these people don't even vote in the Palestinian Authority because they're refugees. So the Palestinian Authority has turned its back on them also. In any event, they rely on UNRWA for education, for healthcare, and for old age security. And Jordan is prepared to provide all of those things to all the refugees who return. So if you cut off their these things from them in Gaza and in Judea and Samaria, they have no choice but to go to Jordan to get that support. So that's a very important concept of what we are, what we have in mind as a inducement. Then there's another concept for an inducement. And one thing that Bennett and Netanyahu and Lieberman all talked about creating job opportunities in Area C for the Arabs, industrial zones, economic zones, you name it. And in my memo to Kushner, I started out and said, do that in Jordan, not in Area C. Induce them to go to Jordan and create the jobs in Jordan. And so that's part of our thinking, what we want to achieve. And that was another part. I think the basic ideas have been explored, but I want to explore something else in addition to these ideas, how we're going to make this possible. One of the issues is over what period of time. So we thought that let's assume it's going to take 10 years. We don't want to live with the PA for 10 years as numbers are, I mean, they're going to be a thorn in our side and whatever. So the idea came up that, as you well know, Jordan leased for many years, I think two decades, some small pieces of land on their western side near the Dead Sea. They leased it to Israel. So I suggested to Mudar, why don't you take a lease of Area A, all the Area A's, and we'll change Gaza to an Area A, and you will be responsible for their administration in place instead of the PA, and they will wither away. And the terms of the lease will go into all the powers and who will do what and whatever, just like Oslo was really like a constitution, dividing up who does what and where and how. But the key thing with Mudar, everybody refers to him by his first name. The key thing is he believes in cooperation rather than confrontation. And he thinks there's a lot of good can come to both Jews and Arabs if they cooperate. And that idea actually found its beginning in the Faisal-Weizmann Agreement of 1919. And we believe that idea was the fundamental idea in the Abraham Accords. And Mudar will be joining the Accords as soon as he can. But there's got to be good for both sides. He accepts that. And he accepts many things. He even, when I questioned him at one time, what do you think about the Temple Mount? The Temple Mount is a big problem. And he said, we want nothing to do with the Temple Mount. Israel should create their own Muslim waqf to manage it from approved Muslims living in Israel. That was his position. He didn't want the problem. Now, since then, things have expanded a bit. And the United Arab Emirates had showed an interest in having the role of Jordan. And we are presenting this, and here's an idea that I had regarding the Temple Mount, was that whenever there's a riot, an Arab riot, they always say they're there to protect the Al-Aqsa Mosque. That's their holy place, not the Temple Mount. And I said, let's limit the Temple Mount or the Al-Aqsa Mosque to a certain area over which the waqf have precedence, and the rest will be a Jewish holy area that Jews are in control. And that was mooted 4 or 5 years ago. Then there's it's been discussed now that if we have a joint custodianship of let's say the UAE and Israel, I'm sure they can get along and both be responsible to end the violence. So that's another dividend we hope will be collected after this happens. Now, I think that Edie Cohn is going to talk about his proposal for this, one of the speakers, and I won't say further. I have no idea what his proposal is, but I'm with him. Now, there's another aspect. One of the speakers today is going to talk about something that we keep talking about, but not everybody makes it clear why it's so, and that is that roughly 80% of people living in Jordan are Palestinians. How did that happen? Well, Jeffrey Clairfield is going to tell you how it happened. Very interesting. But I want to tell you in my remaining little bit of time, I want to give you another narrative as best I can remember it. I hate to read anything, so I'm going from memory at my aging years. But why are we looking for a state? What's that all about? In 2002, pardon me, there was a summit in Beirut, I think. I don't have my notes in front of me, but the Arab League held a summit, and they came out with a peace plan, which you're all familiar with, and that was the Arab Peace Initiative, it was called, and they wanted all the land that Israel acquired in the Six-Day War be given back and relinquished. At that time, they weren't asking, if memory serves, for a Palestinian state. They just wanted Israel out and give up everything they conquered. Now, just to remind you, remember the pressure that Begin was under when he was signing the Camp David Accords? They wanted him to commit to a Palestinian state, and he dug his heels in, and he only committed to autonomy. So that's a little factor. Now, where did this Arab peace initiative come from? It came from the from Resolution 242 that you've all been heard of and are familiar and studied, but I think I'm going to tell you some things you didn't know. You know that the resolution didn't require us to relinquish all the land, the resolution allowed us to remain in occupation. This is a Security Council resolution to remain in occupation until such time as we have secure and recognized boundaries. That you're familiar with. And you're also familiar with this word, a weird recital, which says, emphasizing that no land can be acquired by war. Now, it should be pointed out that the mere fact that we are allowed to keep some of the land and to wait for secure borders flies in the face of that principle of every inch. They're totally contradictory. That's what was decided. But I wanted to point out that they're totally in conflict. Furthermore, that's not the end of the story. The question comes up. The Security Council didn't seem to care about the where the land came from, like what its history and who had rights. None of that was discussed. And it's very important to look at that. And this is very interesting. This land, in law, regardless of what they tell you, was Jewish land. No ifs, ands, or buts. And Eugene Kantorovich dug up a very, very important principle. And he said that when a country declares independence, as Israel did in 48, it usually comes after a war. And the question comes up, where are the borders of that state that is being declared? And he says, international law says they were the last recognized borders. And in this particular case, the last recognized borders were the British Mandate, which at that time consisted of all the land west of the Jordan River. And so on that principle, it's all Israeli land. Now, even that isn't the whole story. And we have to go back in time to the San Remo Resolution. And the San Remo Resolution, basically, according to the leading scholar, Jacques Gauthier, he said that it was the San Remo Resolution was an absolute grant to the Jews of the right to have a homeland in Palestine. And there's no question about it. Our title derives from San Remo. Now, when it came to mandate itself, which was signed in 22, Churchill was not our friend. Churchill was in the British cabinet, and Churchill came out with a white paper in 1921. And in that white paper, he started to wobble on our Jewish rights. But he did say one thing of value. he said, our right is a matter of not of sufferance, but of right. So we don't need permission. But what he said to Weizmann was, the League of Nations will not sign the mandate unless you include this particular clause in the mandate. And what the clause was, and it's clause 25, the clause was that the Jewish Zionist provisions in the mandate, allowing us to have a home and settle and you name it, did not apply to all the lands east of the Jordan River. And Weizmann had no choice but to accept that in order to get the mandate signed. So at that particular time, the Jewish home or right to a home was on all the land west of the Jordan River. Now, Britain immediately began to violate that and did all kinds of things to inhibit our settlement and inhibit what they had originally agreed to do. And they brought in the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem to manage Arab affairs, and they encouraged tens of thousands of Arabs in surrounding states to emigrate, and they discouraged Jewish emigration. And according to Churchill, and this is one of the things in his white paper, that Jewish emigration would be limited to the absorptive capacity of the land, which allowed them to undermine their commitment to us, to close settlement. And so that was the first thing they did to limit the Jewish population there. And then in 36, in the Peel Commission report, wanted to further divide our Jewish homeland into an Arab part and a Jewish part. And that particular recommendation went nowhere. But in 47, they got the General Assembly to pass the partition plan, which once again recommended partition, which itself was a violation of the mandate, which guaranteed us all the land, and a violation of San Remo. But Britain did more that was outrageous. And if you ever wonder how the Irgun and everyone else was so patient, many think that they were terrorists and not patient. They were fighting a bitter enemy. And just as an example of the bitter enemy, and this is less known in history, Britain got a pass for the Holocaust, whereas all blame was on the Nazis. What do I mean by Britain got a pass? Aside from the fact that when the war started, Britain came out with a limit of 70,000 immigrants and wouldn't allow Jews in and closed us down to a meager number, 75,000. And they even killed tens of thousands of Jews in ships trying to get to Israel. And I made the a metaphor. I said, here Germany was herding all the Jews into extermination camps or barns, and they would set the barn on fire. And Britain was standing guard over the barns so that no one could escape. That's the truth. That's history. Now, so, and I'm sure that Begin understood how much of an enemy Great Britain was. And even when Great Britain left and the mandate ended, they left all their police stations and armament and equipment to the Arabs. And you may recall, I'll just mention this, that America had an embargo on all arms supplies to the Middle East. And even although Truman thought that Israel would lose the war in 4 months, he did not lift the embargo. And Israel had to go through hoops to protect themselves. Okay, I've overstayed my time. I thought that you would be interested in this, and I want to mention one other thing that I want you to be sure to read, because it's a hugely important article, and that is it's one of the places of the articles, the 100-year betrayal of Israel by the West. And I went through from 1917 to 2017, 100 years of all the ways the Western powers screwed us and continue to do so. So that's concludes my remarks. And let's see who the speaker is that is next in line that I can introduce. Yeah, the 100-year betrayal of Israel by the West. Very important article. Okay.